I may be misreading the court, but certainly it seemed like two or three or four of them were a bit confused by the case and how they wanted to proceed.
The Supreme Court justices hear the Sturgeon case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, House Minority Leader Chris Tuck on what lawmakers should and should not do with state funds.
There's a lot of mega projects that, you know, Alaskans right now can't afford five mega projects going forward.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. From Ketchikan to Kotzebue, Alaskan lives are salmon lives. Join the Salmon Project this winter as they learn how Alaskans from every corner of the state live lives full of salmon. Learn more at salmonproject.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The justices of the U.S. Supreme Court this morning debated whether the Park Service can impose its rules on rivers that flow through Alaska's national park units. The case began in 2007 when rangers in the Yukon Charley River's National Preserve told Anchorage moose hunter John Sturgeon he couldn't operate his hovercraft there. It has morphed into a debate on federal overreach, the Park Service's duty to protect rivers, and the meaning of a single sentence in ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Sturgeon was in the chamber today to hear the complex legal arguments spawned from that encounter with park rangers more than 8 years ago.
Well, I think it was a great experience. I learned a lot. I don't quite understand all the nuances. That's what the attorneys are for. And it's very privileged to be here.
The justices for a while seemed stumped by a single word, solely. The context is that when Congress passed ANILCA in 1980, it created a lot of new park and preserve lands in Alaska. ANILCA says the Park Service can't treat the state and private lands that were engulfed by these new conservation units as though they are park lands too. ANILCA says non-federal lands and waters are exempt from rules that apply solely to federal land within these units. But defining the rules that don't apply is a puzzle at the heart of the Sturgeon case. Sturgeon's attorney, Matthew Findlay, argued none of the Park Service rules apply to a navigable river like where his client was because the feds don't own the river. Sturgeon lost in the lower courts. The Ninth Circuit Court ruled that non-federal areas of the park, like the river, are only exempt from Alaska-specific park rules. That court reasoned the hovercraft ban is national, so it applies. Justice Samuel Alito pressed the government attorney to disavow that reading of solely in ANILCA. "Why don't you concede that it's wrong?" Alito asked. "It's a ridiculous interpretation, is it not?" The packed chamber erupted in brief laughter. Outside the court, the attorneys involved talked to reporters.
No, I think it's a complicated case with complicated issues. I think that I was definitely pleased to see that everyone seemed to be on board that the Ninth Circuit decision has to go out the door.
John Katchen wrote a brief supporting Sturgeon on behalf of Alaska's congressional delegation. He says the court could overturn the Ninth Circuit's holding and still rule in favor of the Park Service. Or they could rule for Sturgeon. Or, Katchen says, they could send the case back down and have the Ninth Circuit try again.
I may be misreading the court, but certainly it seemed like two or three or four of them were a bit confused by the case and how they wanted to proceed.
Valerie Brown of the environmental law firm Trustees for Alaska wrote a brief backing the Park Service. She says the justices seem to be rightly focused on navigable waters, not land.
So basically, the Park Service has always managed navigable waters since its inception. And it clearly has the authority to do that because ANILCA says to the Park Service, go and manage these rivers. You have to allow motorboats and you have to allow plane landings, but you make all the other decisions. You protect the park resources. You're here to protect fish and wildlife.
John Sturgeon says he still goes on his annual moose hunt in the same area, but he takes his jet boat or a small airboat. Sturgeon says he's had no more confrontations with park rangers.
Have you run into them since, rangers?
They've kind of avoided me. So. In fact, I go on this side of the river and I see them going that side of the rivers.
As for the hovercraft itself, Sturgeon says it's in his yard in South Anchorage under a blue tarp.
I still got it. The engine is in the garage. And when I win, I'm going to put it back in and I'm going to go moose hunting again.
There's no telling when the court will issue its opinion, but likely before the current term ends in June. Reporting from the Supreme Court, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaskans are increasingly concerned about the $3.5 billion state budget shortfall, and they're interested in using both state spending cuts and new revenue to close the gap. That's according to the Rasmussen Foundation's Plan for Alaska, which surveyed 800 Alaskans earlier this month. Compared with a similar survey in July, the share of residents who are extremely concerned about the shortfall rose from 31% to 43%. Two-thirds of residents want to close the shortfall with both spending cuts and new revenue, while 30% want only cuts. Rasmussen Foundation President Diane Kaplan said a majority in every region of the state supported a statewide sales tax. That's true even in areas that already have local sales taxes. And while introducing a state personal income tax is the least popular option, with only 40% supporting the idea, Kaplan says support is greater if the tax were limited to those with higher incomes.
We then looked a little more deeply on the income tax, and we asked, would you support an income tax for people who earn $100,000 or greater? And as you can see, a majority of Alaskans accept those who earn $100,000 or more. Thought that was a great idea.
Cutting spending is popular, with 55% supporting $500 million in cuts. But when asked for areas to reduce spending, fewer people could identify specific cuts. Governor Bill Walker's new budget plan, which includes a smaller amount of spending cuts, has the support of 55% of residents who've heard of it, but most people don't know much about it yet. We're talking with legislative leaders this week as part of a series on the start of the legislative session. Anchorage Representative Chris Tuck is the minority leader in the state house. He questions whether the governor's budget proposal is fair for average Alaskans.
One of the concerns that I have is, you know, working family of four, making sure that they're not taking the brunt of the burden, and that, you know, when we look at fish taxes, when we look at oil taxes, when we look at mining taxes, looking at all those other things, just weighing it in perspective. And so I just want to make sure that the working class isn't fully burdened with the responsibility.
Well, when you say fully burdened, do you think that there does have to be, I mean, where's your cutoff? When does the middle class have to contribute, or at what level would you be comfortable with?
Well, we're all in this together, and everybody's going to have to pay. But the way that the governor's plan is right now, I mean, you take an owner of a wealthy utility, and you compare what that person's going to be having to pay out of his pocket versus a working family of four, it's really bent on one direction. And so the governor's plan is a good start. It is courageous. He does have inclusions from everyone. But just for example, mining taxes hasn't been looked at in decades. And all he plans on generating from that is an additional $12 million. But you look at alcohol taxes alone, and that's $40 million. So we're going to be bringing in over 3.5 times more in alcohol taxes than we are on mining taxes. And if we're going to open up mining taxes, we need to seriously look at, is this going to be fair in comparison to where we're gathering money from people in other ways?
When you're talking about the total package and raising revenue, what about the budget cuts to fill this $3.5 billion budget gap? What else do you think needs to be looked at as far as cutting?
Well, there's a lot of mega projects that, you know, Alaskans right now can't afford 5 mega projects going forward. I know right now, for example, is the Sitna Dam. It's something that I've always supported. I support hydro projects. That is a renewable energy in my mind. But then when you look at some of the power generation projects that we have going through the state, especially in South Central Alaska, a lot of natural gas facilities just got built. So maybe now is not the time to do that, since price of gas is so low, and we've already met the needs with a little bit of extra capacity in the most recent years.
Democrats have introduced dueling bills, one to limit the session to 90 days and one to move it back to 120 days. What's your opinion? Is 90 days long enough?
Obviously, last year, 90 days was not enough. There's questions about whether this year, 90 days is going to be enough. We have a, right now, constitutional limit of 120 days. I can tell you that when I first got elected, I fell underneath the 90-day session, and it was the first year that we were that initiative took action. And it's like cramming for finals every night of the week. I mean, you're really moving under a 90-day session, and it is difficult to build relationships and to have the necessary dialogue to have good policy. So there's a balance. I like it that its statute right now is 90 days, but if we need to go over, we do have it for 120 days. We're a non-binding caucus, so that's the reason why we have different opinions coming from our caucus, because people vote their conscience on that. So it all depends on if we can get more work done in the interim. I do support the 90 days.
Chris Tuck is the minority leader in the House. Tune in tomorrow for a conversation with Senate President Kevin Meyer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the history of a long overdue recognition for an heroic rescue.
And 7,000 volts had gone through Mr. Hunter's body, and he screamed, he went unconscious.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Iditarod organizers continue to look at Fairbanks for restarting this year's race. Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Carl Castle met with race officials in Fairbanks yesterday.
They think that they probably have enough snow, if they don't lose it, to be able to restart in Willow right now. But if the weather warms up at all, they've got a major problem on their hands.
Castle says numerous Fairbanks area restart sites are being considered, but local conditions aren't ideal either, pointing to potential issues with Chena River ice.
The river up through town is worse than it's ever been, but the ice at Pikes currently doesn't look too bad. We're concerned, however, because upstream, not very far upstream at all from there, the ice is worse than it normally is this time of year.
The 2003 and 2015 Iditarod restarts took place along the Chena River at Pikes Landing. Castle, who has extensive experience organizing dog races, says ice conditions are key to a Pikes restart.
The first year in 2003, the emergency operation plan we came up with worked pretty well starting out of Pikes, but didn't work so well last year because the ice on the river got thin, and so everything had to be on dry land, and there just isn't enough space there to really accommodate the start at that location if we have to be off the river.
Castle says officials toured alternative Fairbanks area restart sites yesterday, including the borough's Tanana River Lakes Recreation Area and off the Richardson Highway in North Pole. An official decision on the restart will be made by the Iditarod Trail Committee on February 12th. Bad snow conditions and no flexibility in the Federal Wilderness Act will mean a lack of the Kenai Peninsula's premier mushing race this year. KDLL's Jenny Nyman has the story.
The 30th anniversary will have to wait. The Tustamina 200 sled dog race, scheduled for January 30th, has been canceled.
It's the third year in a row that we don't have the snow conditions to make the race happen.
That's Tammy Murray, race director. The race route from Kisilov to Homer and back through the Caribou Hills is more ice than snow, crossing several large streams that aren't frozen over. Murray said that the only way to find snow and avoid dangerous water crossings would be to move the race to the upper elevations of the hills, but that's a federally designated wilderness area of the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. The T200 Board of Directors requested an exception from the Wilderness Act stipulation that bans competitive races. in hope of being able to use a 30-mile section of trail on the refuge. But word came Wednesday that the request was denied.
Don't want people to be discouraged with the refuge because they did actually do what they could to try to help us. But there's only so many laws that can be bent, and that definitely is not one of them.
The area is open to public use, and snow machiners and mushers have been enjoying the powder up high. But T200 racers won't be among them. Murray said that refuge manager Andy Loringer broke the news to her Wednesday afternoon.
A valiant effort on everybody's part and the refuge as well. Andy did all he could, talked to every agency about it, and just could not find a way, a loophole, to allow us in.
The board could have postponed the race a week, but the long-term forecast doesn't promise much snow, nor cold enough temperatures to count on the stream crossings freezing over.
We definitely worked hard and looked at every option we could, but to put on a safe race is virtually impossible in the conditions we have.
Murray said the T200 board will just have to start planning for next year's race.
Yeah, I don't think we'll have any problem with our sponsors. They understand that weather is a huge part of what we're doing, and the volunteers will come no matter what. Disappointing to them because it's a fun event and they like to be a part of it, and the community itself will be disappointed, I'm sure.
And hope the wimpy winter weather streak doesn't continue for a fourth year. In Kenai, I'm Jenny Nyman.
The enormous $940 million class action lawsuit against the BIA on behalf of tribes cleared the last court hurdle today in New Mexico. The case stems from decades of short-funding tribal contracts. More than $100 million will be awarded to tribal organizations in Alaska. The settlement is similar to one reached with the Indian Health Service last year that also found tribes had agreed to contract amounts for tribal services, but were then shorted the funds or in some cases not awarded any money at all for the signed contracts with the federal government. The Rama Navajo tribe started the suit, which eventually became a class action for hundreds of tribes and tribal organizations across the nation. The suit covered BIA tribal contracts from 1994 until 2013. After the tribes won, notices went out to them laying out the settlement. Lloyd Miller is one of the attorneys working the case for tribes. He says a November deadline for tribes to object to the settlement terms passed with no disagreement.
Which was stunning to us because a settlement that involves this kind of money and a lot of tribes, people are experienced with the Cobell case, which was in some corners very controversial, not here. Absolute agreement across Indian country. And these are tribes that stand to gain a lot of money. Over 500 tribes are getting at least $100,000 out of the case, and as I said, into the millions and even tens of millions. So they've had their lawyers poring over it, and none of them objected to anything.
Although no tribes objected to the amounts or the terms, Miller says they did hear from tribes that had been missed.
And the databases that the BIA had used to develop the master list was incomplete. So we found another database, and from that database we picked up another 55 tribes and intertribal organizations, many from Alaska. So now we have a total of 699 Alaska Native villages, American Indian tribes, and intertribal organizations.
He says the incomplete lists were the result of software changes within the BIA over the course of the 20 years the litigation has been ongoing.
We were tasked with trying to combine software from many different sources and produce a master database that we could use in the case. We needed to use that software to do a statistical sampling of the whole class of all 10,000 contract years that were at issue in the case. I hope that the BIA takes this to heart. We can't, in this case, get them ordered to do record keeping in a certain way, but I think they've learned a sobering lesson in finding out that they've missed 55 tribes.
Miller says today's hearing was the last check-in with the court after the additional tribal groups had been included in the settlement. He says Judge James Parker should issue his final orders in the case within 2 weeks. Payments will be issued towards spring. Miller says 209 tribes in Alaska will receive more than $123 million. A man with a long history in Alaska newspapers is the new publisher of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Fuller Cowell was introduced as the newspaper's top executive on Tuesday, shortly after the sale of the newspaper from Dean Single William Dean Singleton to the Helen E. Snedden Foundation closed. Snedden's husband, newspaper owner Charles Snedden, died in 1989, and his heirs sold the Newsminer to Singleton in 1992. The 63-year-old Cowell began as a paper carrier on Fort Wainwright when he was 9 years old. Cowell later became a newspaper executive with the McClatchy newspaper chain and served as publisher of the former Anchorage Daily News from 1991 to 1999.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Scientists from up and down the West Coast are gathering in Seattle this week for a conference on a giant mass of warm ocean water that has lingered in the Northeast Pacific. After more than 2 years, the blob may be dissipating, but its effects may last for years. The second Pacific Anomalies Workshop runs today and Thursday on the University of Washington campus. Washington State climatologist Nicholas Bond says scientists will discuss how the blob is affecting marine life and climate and what kind of impact El Nino is having on the warm water anomaly.
We'll be able to kind of figure out, well, just what were some of these effects here? Where were the surprises and so forth? And so we plan to really try to figure out what's going on here because it is a big deal for the ocean and it's such a chance to learn how it all works.
This is the second conference on the blob. The first was held last May in San Diego. Scientists tried to anticipate impacts on marine life and climate. Bond identified the increasing sea surface temperatures starting in October 2013 and coined the nickname the blob. There's a large pool of applicants to be the University of Alaska Fairbanks' next chancellor. In a wide-ranging address to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday, interim UAF Chancellor Mike Powers updated members on the hiring process.
The search committee has been formed of faculty, staff, students, and administrators. They've met a number of times. 41 applications have been received. Vetting will occur in February. Visits in March offer probably in April, May, and then a transition in the early summer.
Powers, who was brought in last year to take over for retiring former Chancellor Brian Rogers, has been guiding UAF through a tumultuous time, including review of its handling of sexual assault cases on campus and a continued decline in state financial support. Powers says UAF is expecting another big budget gap in FY17.
FY17 is projected to be $26 million, so that's what we're working against this year as we balance the budget, a $26 million gap.
Power says the projected shortfall follows on those of three previous years, which have totaled $42 million, resulting in the loss of 350 employees and phasing out and consolidation of several programs.
As we grapple with this economic challenge on our doorstep, we'll balance the budget. We'll do so thoughtfully. There will be changes, but the focus is going to be delivering world-class Arctic research and meaningful undergraduate, graduate degrees, workforce development initiatives through CTC that build a great community, a great state, and ultimately a great nation.
Powers would not predict how many more jobs might be lost. He does not solely attribute the budget situation to reduced state funding, additionally citing rising fixed costs and below-average UA tuition rates. 2 weeks ago, we brought you a story about Army Staff Sergeant Joshua Snyderman being awarded the Soldier's Medal, one of the highest military distinctions. At the time we reported, it was the first time the medal was given for an act that took place in Alaska. That claim, however, is incorrect. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes explains.
There isn't any one big list of Soldier's Medal recipients from the last 90 years. Officials with the Army in Alaska were fairly sure that one had not been issued, but cautioned that the claim was based on institutional memory. After our original story aired, I got an email saying that the medal had definitely been awarded to someone in Alaska before, a National Guardsman for a rescue that happened two decades ago in the southeast community of Angoon.
Back in 1995.
Randall J. Gamble is from Angoon and was in his 20s at the time, serving in the Army National Guard. During a basketball tournament, the lights went out.
So they were out for a while, and I got nosy and I wanted to go see what's going on.
There was an equipment problem. Gamble was helping a man from the power plant fix it, but soon after, a friend of his, Johnny Hunter, went 30 feet up a ladder, attached his harness belt, and then made a huge mistake. He touched the wire while it was still live.
And 7,000 volts had gone through Mr. Hunter's body, and he screamed. He went unconscious.
Gamble was down below. He told some other men to call the fire department and leapt into action.
I looked up and said, "Holy shoot." And as I did that, I went up after Mr. Hunter and secured Mr. Hunter and had shaken Mr. Hunter rigorously to see if he was all right.
According to the military citation, Gamble performed CPR and kept Hunter away from the charged lines for 45 minutes until rescuers could get to them. He was put up for the Soldier's Medal, an extremely rare award. It's given when a member of the military risks his or her life to save someone else in a non-combat setting. So, for example, a power outage during a community basketball tournament. It was 8 years from the rescue until the award was officially issued. By then, Colonel Joel Gilbert was overseeing the unit as it prepared the award ceremony.
I went over to Angoon probably about a month prior to start coordinating with village elders and start making sure that we could accommodate a nice award presentation for Sergeant Gamble.
Gilbert says the whole reason for the pomp and circumstance is recognition.
No matter how many years it takes, we should take care of our soldiers and follow through and do the very best we can for them. And for something like that, I especially believe we should recognize a soldier in their home community, because as a National Guardsman, you're a citizen soldier. That's to me what it's all about.
The 8-year delay, Gilbert says, was an unfortunate byproduct of bureaucracy and the analog technologies of the time. For Gamble, the incident was never about military distinction. It was about helping a friend in an emergency. He says the recognition was nice, but sadly, by the time it came through in 2003, the man he'd saved wasn't able to be there. He'd passed away from cancer. Gamble left the Guard in 2004 and still lives in Angoon. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Matt Miller, Annie Feit, and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jenny Nyman in Kenai, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaskan lives are salmon lives. Every Alaskan is connected to salmon, whether living in downtown Anchorage or on the Yukon River. So this winter, join the Salmon Project as they journey across the state. Join the journey at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Happy New Year! Start the year off right by filing your 2016 PFD application. Don't forget to sign your application electronically or by printing a signature page. The deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st, 2016. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.